This podcast is brought to you by the Institute for Creative Enterprise at Edgehill University. During this episode of the Lonely Arts Club, we revisit some of the highlights of Series 1. In this episode, Martin McQuillan speaks to Gemma Bodenay about her career as a theatre director and how the journey all started in a call centre. Gemma is the artistic director of the Liverpool Everyman Theatre.
I think I lived in my imagination a huge amount. My first memories of myself in the playground are bossing other children around saying, no, you're a fairy and you're an angry giant. Could you be angry? Sort of directing, weirdly. I was rarely the fairy or the angry giant myself. I loved stories. I loved creating stories and I loved reading and still do. So I was quite, I suppose, bookish and living in a fantasy land. And also, you know, my mother was a very extraordinary woman, and I suppose I got very, very involved in adult conversations, I suppose, at a much younger age than maybe a lot of children did, by the virtue of the fact that her life was what it was. So, you know, we didn't get babysitters. I'd go to the parties. I'd go to the dinner parties. I'd overhear adult conversations. I was fascinated by people. And because, you know, I don't want to be down on my mum, but her life was difficult. And I would watch her have arguments. I'd try and direct them in my head. Oh, no, you shouldn't have said that. Oh, you've said that. And I think it was a kind of fantastic territory to learn about human psychology and how we interact with each other. And she was really determined that I would be successful. I mean, even to the point that I speak the way I do. You know, I was born in Barking in Essex, and I have a lot of very lovely family still in that part of the East End. But you can probably tell I don't speak like that. So, yeah, she was very ambitious for me. And I was lucky, I suppose, that I love school. I mean, it's a really uncool thing to say, but I loved school, and I would leave school and go straight to the library, and I would get reports that would beg my mother to tell me to do less, you know, that they couldn't, they didn't have the time to read my essays. I was very fixed and very, still am, very fascinated by human beings. And I think what was really useful about it was, my mother was very beautiful, and she would have, sometimes we'd be living, you know, with someone who had a yacht, and I'd be mixing with incredibly sort of well-to-do people. And then we'd be living in her car because she'd had to leave, and we'd be living in a squat, or we'd be back in social housing. So in terms of seeing the world, I think I felt confident about mixing with most people and got to see aspects of life that I'm sure either rich children don't get to see or children from less privileged backgrounds don't get to see. I got to inhabit lots of different lives. I started working in a call centre, and that was a really fabulous time, bizarrely. I mean, it's the most boring job I've ever had in my life, but I'd found the job via the stage, and they were obviously looking for people, actors, I think, who had a good phone voice. And the whole office was populated with lovies who were fantastic. And I kind of have very fond memories of working there. But meanwhile, I was sending out letters to everybody saying, could I be an assistant? And Max Stafford Clark at the Royal Court, God love him, had a policy of answering every single letter that came to him asking to be an assistant, of which there were hundreds, you can imagine. And he saved them all. And then went through a very lengthy interview process to choose one. It was unpaid, again, something that's not allowed now. But I went through quite a lengthy interview process. And in fact, was sent away the first time. It's a lesson to anybody that's listening that wants to become a director. Here's a tip. The first interview lasted, I think, about 10 minutes. He began the interview by saying, well, this is a really important role. I need to know you really love my work. What have you seen of mine? And what did you like about it? And I sort of feebly went, oh, well, I've been working in a shoe shop, and now I'm working in telesales, and I don't have much money, and I haven't actually been to the Royal Court, and I was at university at Trinity, so I didn't get a chance then. And he went, well, I'm afraid that's the end of the interview. And he gave me what was then called a writer's card, I think, which allowed you to get into any Royal Court show for 50p. If you presented this card. And he said, I will interview you again, but not until you've seen some of my work. So I did go and see some of his work, and he did re-interview me. And unfortunately, I didn't really like it. That I remember that thinking, oh no, of all the things I've seen of his. And it wasn't awful. It just wasn't one of those times when you go into an interview and go, oh my God, I loved everything you did. It was sort of okay, I thought, in my arrogance. I mean, let's be honest, I had all the arrogance of youth and thought I was a genius. So he did interview me again, and I got to be an unpaid assistant there. I think what I didn't appreciate was how ridiculously lucky I was to get that job. I think because I was so arrogant, and I genuinely thought it's only a matter of time before my genius is acknowledged by the world, that I sort of took in my stride getting that job with Max in a way that I wouldn't now. And you kind of look back on this young person and think, I just get more and more fearful as I get older. But I used to kind of storm into his office when he was in a meeting going, why have you asked me to do some photocopying? When are you going to give me a show? And he'd be going, you're not getting a show, Gemma. You're going to do my photocopying. But I had this ridiculous confidence back then. And it just snowballed from there because he recommended me to Harold Pinter and I ended up being his assistant. And then Harold recommended me. And, you know, I was very, very lucky. Maybe why they recommended me, apart from, you know, any talent I might have, was this confidence. Because Max, the second day of rehearsals at the BBC, he put me in a rehearsal room with Leslie Sharp, Deborah Finlay and Leslie Manville and said, direct this scene, I'm going to be directing this scene in another room. And he didn't know. I mean, I was just out of uni. And I just had to hit the road running, you know, and give them notes. And apparently they came back and went, she knows what she's talking about. But there was no room for nerves or shyness with Max. It was, you know, straight in there.
In this episode, Martin McQuillan speaks to Mike McCartney about growing up in Liverpool, being a member of Scaffold, and his new album release.
The first house I do remember is 72 Western Avenue in Speak, which was where my mum was the midwife. And I remember the first time she put me in school, sort of preschool or, you know, little baby school, when I was about 4 or 5. And this is Stockton Wood Road School, it was called. So Mum takes me into this little room, all these other little children. Look, Michael, look at these little children. They're just like you. You can play with them. I could slowly see her edging out the room and, yeah. And then what do? You have your little drink and the drinky poos. And then and you have a little sleep in the afternoon. Here's a little bed. I remember to this day, a grey blanket with red piping on it. And you can lie down, have a little rest in the afternoon. Yeah, and she's going towards the door. And then slow, right, all right then, teacher. And what do you mean? Oh, out. She's out. I'm out after her. And I remember her going through the gates, and I am going to try and close the gates, and there's these iron bars, a 4-5-year-old child looking through my mother, disappearing forever out of my life, getting further and further away in her outfit with her bag, a midwife's bag. And she said, don't worry, I'll be back in a minute, just you and her. All she was doing, going down the end of the street, going down the corner, there was our house. The school backed onto her. So that was the first memories of that house. If you go up now, past our house on the right in Western Avenue, keep going there, go through the Bluebell Woods, go down to Oglet Shaw, and there's the River Mersey. Now, if you try and do that, there's an airport called the John Lennon Airport in the way. So all these things are very weird and wonderful, the way everything is, all the jigsaws fit in. And Mum was the midwife there. And in fact, I'll tell you an interesting thing. I've remembered her bloody name. I keep forgetting it. Carey Mulligan. And I want to tell this story. I could never remember. Have you ever heard of Carey Mulligan? Carey Mulligan is getting to be quite a big film star.
Well, that Carey Mulligan, yes. Okay.
That Carey Mulligan. Right, with Meryl Streep, yes, and the Suffragettes, etc. Carey Mulligan. And she's just something like the thing is, there's Meryl Streep next to her. There's this big movie. You come, you're English actress. You come over to Hollywood. You're now in the major league here. And she's on the red carpet in Hollywood. and doing this very big interview with the top of America's Martins, all the mega Martins were interviewing. And suddenly our kid goes past in the background. She sees him at the corner of the eye. And she says, hold on a second, and runs after our kid. But he's gone into the BAFTA or Golden Globes, whatever it was. And she's gone, and she whooped back to becoming famous and says, I'm sorry about that. They said, excuse me, Curry, but why did you run after a Beatle Paul McCartney? She said, because his mother brought my dad into the world. Speak. My mum brought Carey Mulligan's dad onto this earth. And a lot of people have come up to me over the years and, Rayla, you're a member of my sister or me or, you know, into the world. And then I said to the boys, Brian Epstein has asked me to be a pop star. What do you think? Do you think we should have a go at being in the NEMS stable? And so they said, well, we're getting nowhere now. You get more publicity, obviously, in the NEMS thing with all those pop stars. And so we had a go. And so the natural thing would be to do songs, but we didn't want to do songs. But there was one that we liked, and we chose to do it because we were contrary. We were satirical comedians with poetic word imagery. So just to do the normal thing would be no good. So instead of all the how do you do chugga 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 you bang dang dang laga dang dang dang, our first record was a Cockney dirge. So you got, it was on Top of the Pops once, and there they all the records, ang chugga ting chugga ting ting, and now is Scaffolds, Today's Monday. Today's Monday, today's Monday, Monday's washing day, is everybody happy? You betcha life we are. Today's Tuesday, today's Tuesday. It kept going on and on and on till it got to Sunday. Sunday was good. When it got to Sunday, today's Sunday, today's Sunday, Sunday's church, Saturday's payday, Friday's feast, Thursday's shepherd's pie, Wednesday's roast beef, Tuesday's soup, Monday's washing day. Is everybody happy? You bet your life we are. That was our first record. And we recorded Dirty the Pink. And I go into the thingy with Norrie Paramore, he was the producer, and Mike Vickers from Manfred Mann was doing the musical arrangements. And there's the session musicians, there they all are, and yet again more, the best session men you can get. And I said to Mike, what the hell is he doing there? So he just wants it's a gig, he just wants in between jobs. I said, can I have a word with him? He said, yeah. So I sneaked out. And all the other musicians, session men, were there. And so I sneaked up to this bloke, Scottish bloke, actually, and said, Jack, on this number, you can do whatever you want. Because I was talking to Jack Bruce from Cream. He was the bass player on Lily the Pink. He says, Mike, I've been looking at the dots on this one. I've got to be honest with you. I think the best thing on this, drink, Lily the Pink, we had a boom, 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 boom. I said, Jack, whatever you want. Jack, Cream, Bruce, you could do what you want, son. Whenever you hear it again, then listen to the next bit. It was called Jennifer Eccles Had Terrible Freckles. All the boys all called her names. Na, 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 na. I rang Graham Nash from the Hollies. I said, Gray, we're doing a Daft Scaffold song. And the verse in it is taking the mickey out of your Jennifer Eccles. Do you want to come and sing it? He said, I'll be there in half an hour. So he comes down to Abbey Road. When you hear that song, I swear, I listened to it yesterday. It's Graham Nash. It is so Graham. And no, until you point that out, everyone accepts it totally. That's Roger McGough. Mm. Listen to it again. It is so Graham.
In this episode, Martin McQuillan speaks to art consultant Joe Wright about creative industries, national policy, and life after Brexit.
Do you see the creative industries as important to the nation's economy? Do you see it as important to the way that UK is perceived internationally? And the overwhelming response to those questions was yes. I think about 90% of members of parliament felt that it was important and not just economically important. So when you're looking at perceptions of our culture internationally, soft power is a popular phrase. These are things that the creative industries are pumping out quite considerably internationally. So it's not just the domestic productivity that is a benefit. It's also international perceptions. It's spillover effects into regeneration, into communities. So I think if you start to look at the role that the creative industries can play in regenerating parts of the country, Liverpool's classic example of that, and at a hyper-local level, there are parts of Liverpool, Rope Walks, Baltic Triangle, Matthew Street Quarter, which at times in recent history were derelict, were red light areas. Certainly property values were, you know, negligible. And it has largely been cultural and or creative industries activity that has taken them out of that, often supported at key stages with investment from outside the sector, whether that's government investment or private investment by developers. But those have been catalysts. It has been the creative communities that have started to make those areas more desirable to visit, more desirable to live, and thereby helped bring some of these communities back from the brink of being wastelands to being some of the most attractive and valuable parts of the city. In the UK and in most countries that I'm aware of, the creative industries tends to cluster disproportionately around the capital and to a secondary degree around core cities. And there are a number of reasons for this. Density of market, the propensity of people working with ideas and working creatively to want to cluster with other people who can be part of those value chains. Access to infrastructure, digital technology, facilities, universities. So these are all reasons why we tend to see an increased critical mass around London and our sort of second and third tier cities. That's not a bad thing, though it does present some challenges and it raises some questions. Is it too clustered around, in the first case, London and the southeast, at the expense of the rest of the UK? And there's been a general policy acceptance that the answer is yes. And there have been various interventions to try and counterbalance the natural market forces that have led to that. For example, an intervention by the government to try and rebalance the economic and cultural impact and representation of the BBC. It was perceived and could be demonstrated to be too London-centric in terms of where money was spent, where power was held. And the government did one of the things that governments are well positioned to do in terms of market intervention, and it told one of its public service broadcasters to do something about that. And it could effectively mandate that the BBC did something to decentralise or begin the process or make a step change in decentralising what it did. That led to a competition to find a new home. The competition was won by Salford City Council, and the outcome was what we now see as Media City UK. But it was largely driven by a policy intervention, which was decentralise the BBC. Certainly, cultural and creative industries has played a really important part in the history of Liverpool and led to regeneration and economic growth both directly and indirectly. So what I mean by that is it's a cliche, but we cannot escape the enormous significance of the Beatles to the history of Liverpool economically and culturally. On current measures, I think there's about £100 million of music-related tourism in the city, or the city region. And we'd be kidding ourselves if we thought that the vast majority of that wasn't down to the Beatles, but they're not alone. So I think that there are also statistics that Liverpool as a city has had more number ones or has produced artists with more number ones than any other city in the UK, and that includes London. So in terms of brand Liverpool and the association with Beatles and popular music more widely, has had and continues to have a really significant impact on how we're perceived internationally, which helps bring people, talent, tourists, businesses here, and also creates a vibrant sector locally. So it's not just limited to music. I think that in literature, poetry, in theatre, performing arts, in TV production in particular, we can point to some examples where Liverpool has produced output that has been nationally and internationally significant. And again, all of that has helped create a perception and a naturality of Liverpool as a creative hub. So I was, until about 9 months ago, I was the chair of a community interest company, a CIC, that was responsible for the ongoing promotion and development of the Rope Walks district. In the late 90s, it was getting run down, and there was a lot of European money coming into the area, and it was seen as an opportunity to invest in regenerating that area. So again, lots of private development, lots of public funding, and as a consequence, it created a cultural visitor economy type zone. What then tends to happen, though, as I've alluded to at the outset, is it gets full, prices go up, it gets full of people who want peace and quiet. Counterintuitively, some of the people who move into these areas then object because there's a music venue next door or an artist collective, which weren't they the reasons why it was so attractive? So there's a bit of a paradox there. And it can drive out the community that is part of creating that vibrant cultural and creative area. So this happened in Rope Walks. There are still some great assets there. Fact is, one, there are some businesses that are still based there off Bold Street, and it is still a brilliant success story for the most part in terms of visitor economy. Late 2000s, someone got the idea to regenerate a different part of Liverpool, which is now well known as the Baltic Triangle. And this, again, was post-industrial warehouses, very seedy, felt like it was a million miles away from the city centre. And actually, this is quite poignant where we're sat, because one of the first institutions to move to that area was the Picket music venue. And we all thought they were bonkers because, as I've mentioned, it was well off the beaten track, didn't have any footfall, but it moved there and gradually other businesses started to move there. There was very much public intervention in terms of creating the mechanisms that could regenerate the area and working with the community there, transform it from a sort of seedy area that businesses don't want to go, let alone tourists or people looking for a good night out or at the weekend. And it's now one of the most vibrant, districts of the city. And I was witnessing this happening from Cardiff and hence felt I had a fairly objective viewpoint, and we eyed it with envy because it was growing so quickly, and it has become a victim of its success now in the same way that, to a degree, Rope Walks has.
This week on The Lonely Arts Club, Martin McQuillan is joined by iconic Liverpool actor Rita Tushingham, who shares stories about being the face of 60s new wave cinema and what it was like to play such controversial roles.
It was something I knew I wanted to do. It was just like I knew. I don't know. It wasn't something I woke up one day and thought, oh, I want to do that. It was part of me. It was dampened down quite a bit at the convent. I would get the girls all together at lunchtime and we would do little plays and all sorts of entertaining things. But that was frowned upon at that time by the nuns. And I was always doing little bits and pieces and performing and stuff at home, just going off and doing whatever. Sometimes I'd think I was an opera singer and do all sorts of things. I think it's in you, really. And it was while I was at Liverpool Rep that I read in the newspaper they were looking for an unknown actress. Tony Richardson and John Osborne, Woodfall Films, were making the film of A Taste of Honey, and they wanted an unknown to play the role of Jo. And I knew about the play. I hadn't read it. I wrote a letter, sent it to the agent, and sent some photographs. And they said, if you're going to be in London, come to London. So my mum said, yeah, we're going. And that's how that started. And I did audition, and then I did film tests. And then you know, I was so lucky I got the role. Dora Bryan was amazing. She played my mum, and Robert Stevens and Murray Melvin and Paul Dankwa. And it was a small cast, which also helped. And Tony Richardson not only cast his cast, but I always felt that Tony cast his crew because he cast around him and they would do anything for him. He was wonderful to work with, not just for the actors, but for the crew, and very visual in all the things he did. And I was very lucky. I'm sure if it had been in a studio, because it was all on location, one of the first ones to be shot entirely on location. And it was the first film with an interracial kiss as well, which is interesting, isn't it? People were very disturbed by it, actually, because of the content of a homosexual young man and the interracial relationship. And I remember saying to people, I'm going to be doing this, and people who were aware of the play but not in the business said, people's lives aren't like that. It's just being theatrical. It was really strange when you think that there was denial of it, and yet Sheila Delaney wrote it because it was what she experienced as a young girl. I tell you, in Russia, I was called the people's actress. I think that's quite a compliment. But I mean, because I was playing characters that they could identify with in a way, perhaps not necessarily the content, but the fact that the characters were working class characters. So I did Girl with Green Eyes with Peter Finch and Lynn Redgrave.
The Girl with Green Eyes, based on a Edna O'Brien novel, which had itself been very controversial.
Again.
When it had come out. These are edgy choices.
Yeah, well, I'm from Liverpool, you know, we have to have interesting stuff, don't we? You know, we like the controversy. Honestly, you didn't think about that. You thought about the roles and the story. You can't be scared and run away from things. Could you imagine what it would be like? Every film would be the same. They have to be introduced, don't they, all those stories? And we were lucky in the 60s that there was money to be able to do it. Little stories come to mind. I was looked after by Shirley Temple in San Francisco. I went to collect an award there. And Bing Crosby said, Miss Tushingham. So whenever I hear I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, I always think, no one knows, as I'm waiting in the Tesco line to buy whatever I'm buying, that when Bing is singing, I've met him and we've chatted. It's quite, I love those little secret little things that you have in here.
In this episode, Martin McQuillan speaks to Paddy Howie about growing up in Northern Ireland and his career as a journalist since being in Liverpool. Paddy is a writer and broadcaster and expert on media activism.
In working in local papers in Liverpool, I got a great kick of going and working in every area that I could because I'm talkative and I'm nosy and I like finding stuff out and I like speaking to people. And I found a bit of a niche writing features and doing profiles of people. So I worked on Crosby, Herald, Bootle Times, worked on the Anfield and Walton Star and the Mersey Mart, another paper that no longer exists. Then at the same time, I worked for the Daily Post, the great old lady of Liverpool daily journalism. And on the Daily Post, I did feature writing. I wrote reporting shifts, but I also ended up writing a pop music column for it and writing about comedy. And then later on, I was night editor on The Echo. We had a circulation of about 170,000 on a Thursday and a Friday. We produced in Old Hall Street. We had a press in Old Hall Street. You saw the papers coming out four times a day for the four deadlines. It was the last era of old style newspaper journalism. And I really fell in love with the whole thing, like, you know. So you have to rely upon people with a genuine vocation for finding stories out and wanting to do what everyone used to do or what we used to do, which was go to the council meetings, get the council minutes, forge the relationships with councillors, be willing to write stories about your contacts, which are going to be unpopular to those contacts. But there isn't the same investment in it, that kind of investigative journalism because it costs money. Investigative journalists don't do four listicles a day, which gets 600,000 people clicking them or sharing them. You know, it's very much a numbers game of trying to get footfall and numbers through each individual story. That's how big newspaper groups measure the success and reach of stories. Now, an investigative reporter might do nothing for a month and deliver an absolutely sensational 3,000-word piece of reportage and have to go away and do that again. Now, modern local, regional, daily tabloid newspaper journalism doesn't have the space for those sort of people in their newsrooms in the same depth, because they cost much more money than someone who's going to get you millions of hits through what you might think is flim-flam stories on a daily basis. So I remember going back to 2003, 2004, a colleague, a friend of mine who works for Liverpool City Council, saying there's never been a better time to work in a local authority if you want to hide stuff. And this was being said in 2003 and 2004 when the newspaper I worked on still had an investigative unit. Now, think about how the accelerated decline of the local press. They're still breaking stories. The Echo is still breaking stuff around Pall Mall and around New Chinatown and around the kind of issues that, let's not call them corruption, but some of the kind of the murkier end of development in the city. But it can't do it in the way that it did for crime, for instance. The Echo had wonderful crime reporters, wonderful investigative reporters like, Mark Thomas, who ended up as the editor of the Daily Post, who would go off book, as we call them, off the diary, and would come up on every other Thursday or every three Thursdays with a story about local crime. Richard Elias, who now works in Glasgow, wrote the book on Curtis Warren. We won't get another reporter who has the same links to the underworld in Liverpool as we had whenever Elias was on the Daily Post, because there isn't the freedom for him to go off book and make the kind of contacts that he could do. And also there's a kind of romantic element to the job then, that, there was a person with his or her notebook and a pencil and their pen and the press card and the brim of their hat, and every so often they'd come in and give you the story and it'd be dynamite. Well, actually, lots of newspaper groups which rely on getting advertisers through Asda commercials or M&S commercials or Waitrose commercials on their website don't need those people. They need regular footfall to be able to sell goods or to sell numbers to those companies. And that's one of the great tragedies, that we don't see investigative journalism of that old kind in local newspapers in the same depth as we used to. Really, by yourself, you can do something that can have quite a great effect just using these new technologies. And that's what activist journalism is. It's using these new forms of technology, the old structures of journalism, to support a political or social or any other cause. I wasn't an early adopter, really, but I was fascinated around 97, 98, about online and journalism. And I was really fascinated by people who were on message boards. It might have been football fans, or hip-hop was another one. In the olden days, being a lad from an estate in Craigavon, which is a new town, a bit the Kirby or East Kilbride, which never got finished, unless it was on Def 2 and BBC 2, I didn't know what cool music was, unless it was in the NME, or unless I bought a Public Enemy album and I got a magnifying glass and looked at all those wee names that were written and all these mad kind of esoteric New York hip-hop names. And you had to really go out on a kind of treasure hunt to try and find these people. And then all of a sudden, with the net, all of these types of people were seemingly at the end of just a keyboard. So if I wanted to learn a song when I went to Celtic Park to watch a game, I'd have had to go on away buses and be involved in the culture of Celtic Football Club. But no, I didn't, because it was all on a message board. But also, being away from home, I was fascinated by the subculture of Irish Republicans, because I didn't come from a Republican background. I don't come from a Republican family. But Republicans had always been pushed away from the mainstream and shunned. And so there was this subculture of Republicans producing newspapers and magazines and pamphlets throughout the Troubles in Northern Ireland, which had transferred itself, really effortlessly to the online world. And I came in contact with an online magazine called The Blanket in about 2000-2001. And it was run by two people I've become friends with, Anthony and Carrie McIntyre. And what I found really fascinating was that they could put out literally any kind of material that they wanted and nobody could stop them. And there was something genuinely liberating about that. The magazine's politics, I disagree with 90% of them, but I thought this kind of freedom to be able to put this stuff into the public space, into the public realm, was really fascinating, because previously you'd have needed the printing press or a studio or something like that. And if they could do that from a council house in West Belfast, where they were getting picketed by Sinn Féin and they were constantly getting raided by the police service of Northern Ireland, how couldn't a community in Merseyside not try and use that same spirit to write about itself and replace or to fill the vacuum that had happened as the decline of local media? You'd be surprised how many opportunities there are for people who want to go into the newspaper industry at the lower rung of, say, a weekly or a small daily newspaper, say, for instance, like the Evening Leader or something in Wrexham, or some of the family-owned newspapers that still are. But I also think that there are a terrific number of opportunities for people in things like community radio, hospital radio, community activist journalism, where if you have the requisite kind of investment in, are you interested in reading or listening to what you've written or produced and seeing and hearing where the problems are, where it can be improved, then I think there's an opportunity to build a decent profile for yourself within a kind of relatively new area of media, which might be activist media, it might be public relations kind of operation of major companies. But with something like a podcast, if I'm a Liverpool fan or I'm a Celtic fan and I've got three mates or four mates who I think have good patter and they're interesting and they're funny, and I've got something like a Podbean or Audioboom or Audacity on my phone or my computer, I can stick something out, decent quality, when I want. I can choose my regularity. I can decide to break the conventions of publication or of broadcast distribution. But fundamentally, the gatekeeper is gone. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone who does a podcast or everyone who does a community newspaper automatically gets a big audience or is automatically a success. There is still the same kind of shakeout along the same kinds of means that there always has been. So content is king. Is your content good? Is it interesting? Is it informative? Is it funny? Does it capture the attention of an audience that other formats don't? And I think when I look at things like the Cycling Podcast, the Anfield Rap, the Liverpool Podcast, podcast by some comedians. Look at Marc Maron, who was a very bitter, embittered, reasonably successful American comedian who has absolutely transformed the world of podcasting simply by doing these forms of long-form interview, which you don't hear on national radio or national television anymore. And he does it for quite a big niche audience. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people download his podcast every week. I do. He had the president of the USA become the first president on a podcast. That is a paradigm change in how we do media. Getting rid of those gatekeepers and being able to do it in your own way has fundamentally changed what we do.
In this episode, Martin McQuillan speaks to Angela Samata about the arts and mental health, documentary making and the pleasures of sourdough. Angela is an arts professional and was chair of Survivors of the Bereaved by Suicide.
For the last 15 years, I've worked in the arts and I've kind of had a dual career, I suppose, because I work in the arts and I work in lots of art galleries. And I started life at the Lady Lever Art Gallery on the Wirral, actually. But at the same time, I've also spent the last 15 years with a foot in the kind of mental health and suicide prevention camp as well. So my life has kind of been split in two. I found that actually what I needed was not the art therapist that I was given, who was amazing, but wasn't what I needed. What I needed was to just see that other people had gone through this situation and other people had experienced this type of loss, and actually they were okay. So that's when my amazing doctor at the time realised that I wasn't depressed. I was grieving and I needed to be around other people who'd experienced this, because you're right when you say that I'd never experienced anything like it. So I was still working in the gallery, which became very important, that place of calm, that place of beauty in my experience that was very difficult at that time. Being around the art and being around the art gallery and the people in it actually was fundamental to my recovery, really. It was my brother-in-law who said, "Why don't you try this?" And he made me a starter and left me with a book and a starter and said the words, "I know you're not going to do anything with this, but maybe you should." And because he'd set me a challenge, I started. And there is something incredibly therapeutic about using your hands and physically being in touch with the dough and the flour and the water, and then producing something beautiful and edible and hopefully tasty that you can then share. And there is just something about having flour and water on your hands that means you can't answer an email and you can't check Twitter. And it just made me stop. And I'm thoroughly enjoying my sourdough journey and learning and really slowing down because you can't do it fast.
In this episode, Martin McQuillan speaks to Nicola Triscott about art, science and running cultural organisations. Nicola is the director of FACT, the Foundation for Art and Creative Technology in Liverpool.
Nicola, welcome. You have recently started as the boss of FACT.
Boss of FACT.
At Liverpool.
I'm the chief exec, yeah.
What first attracted you to the job of chief executive of FACT?
Oh, it's my dream job. I've always loved FACT. I've done a couple of shows at FACT in the past, and I guess I've looked at it for a few years thinking, gosh, I'd love to run that building, but I never thought Mike Stubbs would ever leave. So when it came up and I happened to be in a position to be mobile with my family life, it was a no-brainer for me. It was just getting it that was then the challenge. Well, FACT is, I think it's more than a building. I love the building. So I'm not completely fixated on just getting people into the building, but on our role as a foundation for art and creative technology. So we already have a lot of really interesting initiatives. There's a very good, strong schools and communities program. As well as our exhibitions program, we do a lot of artist residencies and developing artist research and experimentation. And it's really looking at how we join those up, how we find and nurture the talent that's out there and bring it through, developing structures to bring it through then to support and platform the amazing people who are going to define what this country is going to be in the future. I'd been off traveling in Africa for a year. And I came back and thought, well, I want to be fundraising for the projects that I come up with, not for the projects that other people come up with. So that was when I decided to set up my own company, which was Arts Catalyst, which became my life for the next 25 years, which was entirely unexpected, actually. I just wanted to follow some ideas that I had. And those ideas were that I had one set of friends in the contemporary arts across many different art forms, and then friends that I'd had who I'd met when I was studying physics. And at that point, I know art and science seems a very big thing now, but at that point in the early 90s, there really wasn't much communication between the two worlds. So I thought I would start up a few conversations between artists and scientists and see where that took us for a couple of years, not realizing that 25 years later I would still be facilitating art, science and technology collaborations. I also really wanted to move out of London to a different city. I felt that the London that I'd moved to, which was full of different types of people in this melting pot of cultures doing extraordinary and experimental things, has kind of gone from London. You can't afford to have a culture like that. So I've been thinking for quite a few years now that I'd like to move to one of the cities further north where it felt a bit more exciting and a few more possibilities. So I was looking at relocating Arts Catalyst anyway, outside, and Arts Catalyst under its new leadership, the amazing next generation, is moving to Sheffield. But then FACT came up in Liverpool, and Liverpool is an extraordinary city to move to.
What have you discovered in Liverpool?
I've only been here 4 weeks, so the discovery is slow. I think last weekend I discovered it was probably one of the noisiest, most exuberant cities I could ever have landed in. Being here for the final of the European Championship, that was quite an introduction to Liverpool. But I love the openness here. I love the fact that you can have a chat with anybody and they'll tell you their opinions about FACT or about art or about film or about football or about anything. I love that that openness, and the conversations I've had here have been enormous fun. And there's just this sense of, you know, young people really wanting to do things here, and that sense of possibility as well that I feel is harder to find in London now. just because it's such an expensive city for anyone to live in. Or, I mean, I couldn't have started Arts Catalyst there now, for sure. Part of how I think you keep up with emerging technologies is by being interested in them and by working with universities and industries who are also interested in them. But I think the other important thing is to look back at the other aspect of fact, or the underlying motivation for fact, which was that they were really taking stuff that young people were kind of doing for fun and in their back bedrooms. And, you know, it all came from Moviola, which was started by a couple of students who were interested in setting up a festival around moving image work. So I think that spirit of what and how young people are using technology and digital media creatively now, they may not even be calling it art. That for me is where we start looking, and then helping those young people to connect with possibilities that they might not have had the opportunity to connect with, and giving them platforms for what they're doing.
In this episode, Martin McQuillan speaks to Carl Hunter about his first feature film, Sometimes, Always, Never, his career in the music industry, and his love for homemade soup. Carl is a director, screenwriter, and bass player in Liverpool band The Farm.
The film stars Bill Nighy, Sam Riley, who fantastically played Ian Curtis in the Joy Division film Control, Jenny Agutter, Tim McInerney, Alice Lowe, Alexis Sale, Louis Healy, and Young Ella. And there's a few other people, but they're the main cast. Working with that calibre of actors was great, great fun, and quite easy, I have to say. And I think that's partly down to, I think when you get really good actors and they really buy into the idea of the film, then working with them is actually quite easy, because they bring a lot to the table and they're very enthusiastic. Certainly that group of actors I worked with were also incredibly polite. They were funny on screen, they're funny off screen, they're pleasant, but they're just incredibly good actors, and they can turn a scene round or a line and take it in a completely different direction than I ever thought, you know, I could maybe encourage or direct. And I think when you're working with people like Bill or Jenny or Tim or Sam, I think when they ask the question, can we try it like this, it's difficult to say no, and probably a bit arrogant as well to go, no, we're doing it like this. So it felt far more collaborative than I ever thought it was going to be. Like when I go to Frank's, you know, I go there as a friend. As a byproduct of friendship, we end up making a movie or a play or a book or something. But that's not why I go around to visit them. I don't go to visit to create work. I go to have a laugh, or to see how my mate is, or just catch up with life. But by the time you leave, you think, oh, we've started a film there. And then next thing you know, you sat with Bill Nighy and a film crew. Friendship first, work later.
And sourdough third, surely. If you can make your own sourdough, you can make anything. Multimedia is nothing to you if you can make your own sourdough.
Well, if you make sourdough, you can make a movie. But anyway, I'm a huge fan of Bill Forsyth, and so is Frank. And one of the things I love about Bill's films is he, in his early days anyway, a lot of his films were very much based in working class communities. But what Bill did, which I loved, was he never saw working class people as some kind of anthropological experiment. They're people. And it was quite unusual, because I remember seeing that Sinking Feeling and just thinking it was one of the greatest films ever made. And then seeing Gregory's Girl. And what struck me about Gregory's Girl is, this is a film about working class people who live on a new estate. But what are they? Well, they're not robbers. They're not alcoholics. They're not drug addicts. They're not wife beaters. But that's odd, because most of the films I'd seen up to that point were portraying people who were working class and poorer, who grew up on council estates, as we call them. But these people weren't like that. And only that, they were closer to the world I grew up in, because I grew up on a council estate. And yet the people in Gregory's Girl were the people that lived by me. I'm not saying there wasn't drugs and there wasn't alcohol and there wasn't awful things going on, because of course that exists. But it made me realise quite early on, well, if you want to make a film, you can either stand on top of a stone and look out and around, or you can look under the stone. And both are valid. But as a filmmaker, you have to make a conscious choice. Do I want to look at the optimism of a world or the pessimism of a world? And I've always been drawn towards the optimism of the world. So Gregory's Girl, to me, is one of the closest films made about working class communities I've ever seen, ever. Yeah, you're young, you chase a girl, you don't get her. You try and find a job in those days. You're not pushed to find one. You play football, but you do it badly, because most people are really bad at playing football. You know, and what you do with your day when you live on a council estate, how do you get through your day? And the boredom of the day is taken up by lots of minute little things which fill your day. like climbing trees, like walking, like going to the shopping centre, like buying chips, all those things. And that's what struck me about Bill Forsyth, is he took the ordinariness of life but made it feel special. He made the mundane, to a certain extent, feel quite exotic. I like the sort of gym fitnessness of galleries.
The gym fitnessness of galleries?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, you can join the gym, go to it, and lift weights and run, and you definitely will get fitter as a result of it. Equally, you can go and spend quite a few hours a week in a gallery or a cinema, and you become fitter as a result of it, visually fitter, culturally fitter. So I kind of, it's a fitness regime I like. I have two fitness regimes. One is I do run and swim probably every day, but I also make sure I visit galleries or cinemas quite a few times a week as well. So there is a fitness thing for me, and that really interests me. So critical acclaim is important, I suppose, to me, because it recognises the fact that I am interested in language and I'm interested in art. And if I'm experimenting and doing something influenced by other bits of art, you know, have I misread what I've seen? Have I distorted what I've seen? Have I just got it wrong? But language does interest me. Well, not just spoken language, you know, visual language.
In this episode, Martin McQuillan speaks to Helen Legg, the director of Tate Liverpool, about her life in art, curating, and time spent on the beaches of St Andrews.
I felt at home in the city from day one. I really like Liverpool. You know, it's very warm, it's very welcoming, it's got its own personality, which I like in a city. I like to suss out what a city's all about. It's very different from Bristol, from where I moved. And Tate, you know, Tate's an organisation I've been close to for a long time. I mean, anyone working in the visual arts in Britain is close to Tate. But it's been a real pleasure to become part of it and to see how it works from the inside. And it's full of really incredible, talented, committed people. So far, all good. I mean, Tate is the national collection of British art from 1500 and modern and contemporary international art. And that began when Henry Tate, who actually came from Liverpool and who was a collector predominantly of, you know, British art, included things like the Pre-Raphaelites, for example. He donated his collection to the nation on the understanding that the nation would build a gallery to house his collection in it, and that was Tate Britain. And then the other galleries unfolded over time. So Tate starts life as Tate Britain, British art, 1500 to the present day. And just before 1988, there is the idea that the national collection shouldn't only be seen by people in London and that it should be made more readily accessible to people beyond London. So a search is made for an appropriate venue in the north of England. And that search takes in Manchester, Sheffield, Leeds, and also Liverpool. And it's at the time when there's deindustrialisation on a grand scale in Liverpool, and there has been civil unrest. So the Toxteth riots had occurred around this time. So there's certainly an interest on the part of the government to encourage something new to arise out of Liverpool. And then there's also the desire on the part of the director and the trustees of Tate to take the collection beyond the capital. So that comes together in identifying these buildings that we're now in on the dock, on the Royal Albert Dock, which was derelict at the time. The trustees took that building on and Tate Liverpool was launched. And Tate Liverpool's original remit was modern and contemporary, British and international. So, you know, Tate had begun to collect international work, but it, you know, that jarred perhaps a little bit with some of the British collection. So it was very easy to separate those two things out and have very distinct roles for each of the two galleries. Last year, we attracted 700,000 visitors, many of which are tourists from outside Liverpool. So it plays a really key role in the cultural life of the city, but also the economy. But I would say that Liverpool itself as a city is moving on. So the kind of regeneration that was necessary at the end of the 1980s is, I won't say entirely over, but certainly Liverpool as a city is doing very well now, and it probably needs a slightly different kind of approach, which is actually acknowledging the wealth of, I mean, Liverpool and culture are kind of a really extraordinary pairing. I mean, we've got more museums in Liverpool than anywhere outside London in the UK. We've got fantastic theatres. We've got a symphony orchestra. There's just a real wealth in the collections here. There's a really strong grassroots network of artists and producers. So what I was amazed to see when I moved here was that because property is still relatively inexpensive, young people can stay in Liverpool after they've been students here. They can afford to rent somewhere to live and rent a place to work. They can work with their peers and set up a small gallery or just have a studio and produce their own work. For me, that's one of the most interesting areas to think about in terms of Liverpool and culture, because I've moved here from Bristol, where the property market was completely different and it was becoming, well, it had become almost impossible for artists to stay in Bristol, even though they very much wanted to. They liked the city. They just couldn't afford to pay their own rent plus have a studio or set up a small space. It wasn't feasible for anybody. And even if they found the money, to find the space was almost impossible because it was all being occupied. In Liverpool, you can, and that's quite rare now amongst major British cities. And I think that's something that we need to try to protect so that as regeneration continues, that doesn't get swept away with it. I think because Liverpool has been perhaps slower to regenerate than other cities, we're in quite a valuable position where we can look and see what worked elsewhere and what didn't work and make sure that we don't share the mistakes of other cities. So in terms of culture and Liverpool, I'd say we have a phenomenally strong offer that has contributed to the regeneration of the city. But now it's time to make sure we protect what's there, and that as the city grows ever bigger and ever more economically powerful, we don't lose what makes this city kind of vibrant and exciting and a place where people want to live and a place where people can feel. You know, I think there's a big sense in Liverpool of equality. I don't mean that everyone has the same, but I mean there's a sense in which people are generous towards each other and feel that they can participate in the life of the city. And I think culture probably plays a huge role in that. I wouldn't want to see it get lost.
In the final episode of Series 1, Martin McQuillan is joined by legendary film director Mike Hodges, who tells us all about the highs and lows of directing films like Flash Gordon and Get Carter.
And, you know, when people ask me, how do you start as a film director? Well, I don't think I ever remember meeting anybody else who wanted to be a film director. It wasn't really particularly fashionable in England. So it wasn't anywhere near as competitive as it is now. And also, it was a smallish club, basically. So, you know, you met people, you travelled up to Manchester to do shows in the ABC television, and you were on the train with producers and people like that. So, you know, in quite a short space of time, you got to know people and you were able to sort of talk about what they were looking for, et cetera, et cetera. So you can't answer the question when you're asked, how do you become a film director? Because it's so totally haphazard, or was then. And even now, I think, you know, it's hard. So Derek would ring me up every morning and I'd say, which story do you want me to run with, Derek? And he couldn't make his mind up. Anyway, eventually somebody said to me, you've got to tell him to go after Barry Goldwater, who was the very right-wing Republican candidate against Lyndon B. Johnson. So I'm now in New York. I have no contacts whatsoever. And I ring the telephone exchange from the office there and say, I want to get in touch with the Goldwater for president. This voice at the other said, president of what? So basically, I've got nowhere. But I somehow found that he lived in Phoenix and I would go to Phoenix. And Granada had worked previously when the Beatles, this comes back to Liverpool where I'm sitting at the moment, when the Beatles went to New York, they sent over the Maisel brothers with a director called Dick Fontaine, who was a friend of mine, to cover the Beatles' effect in New York for the big, that Shea concert that was so famous. And the Maisel brothers were incredible because there was one on camera, one on sound, and they're amazing documentary makers. And they never used any lights or anything. So it was an incredible experience for me because filmmaking, even on World in Action, was a very cumbersome process, you know, albeit it was on 16mm, but it was still very plunky. The sound was very difficult and so on and so on. So, but with the Maisel brothers, it was like having a notebook. You know, you just say, look, let's cover that over there, and they get it. And they never used lights. They just had one light on top of the camera. So it was immediate. You know, you could pick up things that, and it was so free. You felt so free working this way. Anyway, so we went to Phoenix and I got lifted off the Goldwater estate when I knocked on the door. Mrs. Goldwater opened the door in her dressing gown. I mean, all of this is completely mad. And I saw that he had a flag, the Stars and Stripes, on a pole there, which had a light meter at the bottom. So when the sun came up, the flag rose on its own. When the sun went down, it went downwards. Barry Goldwater was such an idiot that his family owned this big department store and he designed some underpants for men, right? And he had ants all over them. So these were called ants in your pants. It's the beginning, really, of realizing the American presidency was up for grabs by the most stupid of people. I mean, you really have to understand it's that there was a transition between the author of a book and a filmmaker. And as a filmmaker, you have to make it your own. It's no good sort of trying to pretend that you're the author. So when I was reading it, all these locations that I'd seen during my national service, because it wasn't just, you know, North Shields that I went to. I went to Lowestoft, Grimsby, Hull. All these places came to mind, you know, but I'm now something like 15 years later. So I say to the producer, Michael Klinger, I can see these places and I'd like to go back to them to look. So he got his white Cadillac out, much to my absolute horror, and got his driver. And we drove up the East Coast and we went to, you know, all the way up each fishing port, and they'd all changed. They hadn't exactly been gentrified, but a lot of the old buildings and places had gone. And whilst there is a sort of beauty in poverty, they were just boring now. But, you know, whereas before they were filled with sort of character, albeit a Hogarthian sort of version of life. Now, this time, because I'm coming by land and not sailing in to the Tyne, the Cadillac pulls into Newcastle. And as soon as I see Newcastle, I mean, this great city. I mean, it looks visually, it's such a knockout looking place. And as soon as I saw it, I just knew that this was a place which was hard and rusty and a working town and still poverty stricken in the main and deprived would account for Jack Carter's psychotic behavior, you know. In this specific case of Newcastle and Get Carter, I could root myself like an actor, you know, into a character. I could root myself into this film. And, you know, I used a lot of the people who used to go to Landers House and go to parties there. And I used some of the pubs that they used to meet in because all those days they still existed. And I even found that his house, which he deserted because he did a bunk, right, and he's now living in the Balearic Islands in Ibiza or one of those. So the place was totally empty when I found it hadn't been sold. And I can understand because it was a sort of rather grim place. So I convinced Klinger, though the fact there was a good hour's drive outside of Newcastle to get to this location, that this was where I wanted to shoot, you know, the John Osborne hideout. So that's the actual house, you know, that Vince Lander lived in. And it hadn't been touched since he'd done a bunk. And when Carter runs in, for example, into the house for the very first time, he's being chased, and he leans against the wall, and it's got cowboys and Indians on the wall. I'm sure people think I did that, but it was there. You know, he just used what was there. And the same on the beach at the end of the film. You know, when I found this beach down towards Durham, you know, you saw where poor people had driven down there to get bits of coal. And the tide had come in and their vans had been, you know, they had to leave their van because it got stuck. This is how desperate people were. And the water was black. You know, the beach was black. You know, nobody could think that we dressed it as in the film, but it wasn't. This is exactly how we found it. And it was the sort of remnants of what I'd seen when I'd gone in the Navy 12, 15 years before. So that's the story of Get Carter. And when The Omen came to me, they had asked me to make Omen 1. And I found the script so ludicrous. I kept it in my flat for ages and I'd read bits of it because I found it so funny. But Dick Donner did a brilliant job. I mean, he really did, because the script was not promising, let's put it that way. Anyway, so they came back to me with the number two. And I loved it because, again, as a socialist, the idea of the devil taking over the largest corporation in the world and trying to corner the food market appealed to my political sensibilities. So I said, yes, I'll do this one. But I'm afraid I'm not into horror films. I just don't. It's not my forte at all. So it was inevitable that we would fall out. I've never been so grateful to get off a film in my life. I didn't even accept my fee. I had every right to accept my fee. I said, I don't want any money. I was amongst the weirdest group of people I'd ever met in my life, born-again Christians who come in and say, God, the devil's going to try and stop you making this film. I mean, I was just, it was an absolutely grim experience.
At what point did you walk out on it?
Well, they accused me of being too slow. In fact, the cameraman was slow. You know, I just operated in a very different way. The American directors tend to have a list of things they're going to do that day. I'm always on schedule and I'm always on budget, but I do it in a different way. And I certainly wasn't going to give them a list of shots that I was going to do. I liked to be much more, be freer in terms of my filmmaking. And I had the same thing with Get Carter, you know. I mean, I struggle to do a shot, do a whole scene in one shot if I could, which it takes time to set up, to choreograph, but you save time in the end because if you've got to cover it in the conventional way, which is like watching, you know, Wimbledon, it's shot, boom, boom, close up, you know, wide shot. So if you can get a kind of choreography going, now outside of the set that you're working on, the producer's going mad because it seems that time's running away. But I know that when I come to shoot, I'm saving hours of time, because each one of those setups I've just described is going to take time, and it's going to take the energy out of the actors. If you can manage to encase it all in one shot, the actors are much more acute. They're much more keyed up to do it, and if you get something much more exciting altogether, it takes time to set it up. But in the end, one shot in Get Carter where, you know, he takes, what's his name, back into the room and he's got the bottle of whiskey and the landlady's complaining and he says, you know, and the whole thing, if I'd shot it in the conventional way, would have taken 2 days probably. And I shot it certainly in one day, if not less. So, you know, Omen was, that's why we just kept, I was out. I was never been so grateful. It's very interesting. You can really tell with the bits that I shot and the bits that were shot by the next director.
So that's the context then, right, in which you come to make Flash Gordon, which is your...
Oh, yes.
I needed a film.
So, well, I did need a film, not only financially, but I mean, you must understand that Get Carter, whilst it was a big success, I only got paid £7,000 for writing and directing and no residuals. I've never seen a residual from Get Carter, which is painful. But I was lucky to get off of the film. Anyway, so Pulp was not a success. Terminal Man wasn't a success. So I'm not exactly rolling in. I mean, I've got paid very well, but I wasn't exactly rolling in money. And I now had another period of time where I was under a cloud because nobody quite knew whether I'd been fired from Omen or whether I'd walked. It was sort of a combination of both in many ways, which I was. I mean, on paper, I was absolutely the wrong director to do Flash Gordon. I mean, you look at my record up until then. I mean, you know, for a start, even with the television films, three out of the five films, the protagonist is killed at the end. I mean, this isn't the stuff of sort of science fantasy. And I didn't really know anything about special effects. I was quite a moderately skilled filmmaker. I hadn't really gone into any of the special. I'd never used the special effect in any of those films, you know. So I resisted, and I was offered the sequel to Flash Gordon. I turned it down. And then Nicholas Roeg was meant to be doing the first one, and he and Dino fell out. And then Dino came and found me and sort of talked me into doing it. And my sons also talked me into doing it because they were about 9 or 10 and they thought I should do it. And they were all right because I had a great time. I loved doing it. Well, I was terrified to begin with. Once I sort of got the hang of it all, I was, and I realized that I had to take the film over because Danilo Donati, who was the production designer, and Dino De Laurentiis, whose English was abominable, really, was really mangled, and his ego was enormous. So it was kind of sort of a strange battle which I had with these two elements that I think the film came out quite well with, actually.
This podcast is brought to you by the Institute for Creative Enterprise at Edgehill University, making connections through culture. I'm editor and producer Roz Power, with audio production by Sam August of Onomatopoeia Studios in Liverpool. For further details on the work of the Institute for Creative Enterprise and courses at Edgehill University, visit www.edgehill.ac.uk/ice.